My name is Jeremy White. I'm with the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Today is January 25th, 2008, and I'm here with the Honorable Walter Skolkin as part of the Pony Project to evaluate the U.S.-UK nuclear cooperation as we approach the 50th anniversary of the Mutual Defense Agreement.
Well, insofar as relevant, I graduated from law school in June of 1968 and clerked on the Supreme Court for Justice Fortas during 1968 to 1969. After I left the clerkship, after a brief interval working for Don Rumsfeld in the poverty program, everybody's forgotten that he ran the poverty program under Nixon. I went to work on the National Security Council staff, which was then headed by Henry Kissinger, and I stayed there until, I guess that was, I went there in probably September of 1969 and stayed about a year. And I actually worked at IISS in London for several months and then came back, joined this law firm. And when President Carter was elected, went over to work in the Defense Department as the principal deputy assistant secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, and also as the director of the SALT task force. And in the latter capacity, I reported directly to the Secretary of Defense. The de facto result was that almost everything that had to do with nuclear programs on the policy side, obviously not on the technical side, was in my jurisdiction. And that's how I came to be involved with the UK program. And then, when President Carter was defeated, I came back to the law firm. When President Clinton was elected, I went back to the Pentagon, where I was all during the Clinton administration. Then when the Clinton administration left office, I came back to the law firm. Then I, May of 2003, I went to Iraq for 6 months. When that ended, I came back to the law firm.
When you were on the National Security Council,
I was never on the National Security Council.
On the staff. Sorry.
Yes, there is a difference.
Yes, sorry. Did you work with issues relating to arms control?
Sure. I mean, that was the main thing I did.
So during your various times at the Department of Defense, what advantages did you see for either the United States and the UK coming out of the Mutual Defense Agreement?
By Mutual Defense Agreement, you mean the nuclear cooperation, not the general alliance? Well, a couple. One was that it related to the general alliance, that is, the United States and Britain are probably still, unquestionably still, our closest, Britain is our closest military ally. And the British, under all parties so far, including Labour now, have taken the position that they want to maintain an independent deterrent. And our support and cooperation for that has always been important to their being able to do it in an efficient and effective, both militarily and cost-effective way. The advantage, one advantage the United States has simply to do, it is something we do to support an ally who was very supportive of us in other areas. But it's not, in my view at least, it's not simply something we do to be nice to good friends. I've always believed that the United States gets an advantage in deterrence terms, particularly under the conditions of the Cold War, from there being what the British call the second center of decision. That is, the British were always more polite about it, but the British position and the French position about nuclear deterrence is essentially the same. Which is, I was once told by a French official, I won't do the accent, we have complete confidence that if the Soviet Union were to attack Western Europe, the United States would use nuclear weapons if necessary in our defense. We're just not entirely sure the Soviets believe that. So there's no question we have a nuclear capability so that we can make that decision as well. And the British argument for what they call a second center decision is essentially the same. That is, it meant under Cold War conditions that the Soviet Union realized that if they were so foolish as to launch a major threat to the, not just the, you know, not just a major threat, but an invasion, something that threatened the state existence of Western European countries and allies of the United States, that they would face a very real prospect of, if it was successful, of a nuclear response. And my view, at least, always was that having the Soviets worried about not just our decision, but the decision of people who would obviously be even more directly affected than we, contributed to deterrence in ways that were valuable to the United States, as well as obviously giving a sort of ultimate insurance policy to the British, and for that matter the French.
Has the flow of technology gone both ways over the years, or mostly in one direction?
I know. One of the lurking issues in this whole relationship goes way back to the Second World War, where, as you know, originally the British were probably ahead of the Americans in research toward the development of a nuclear weapon. For various reasons, that whole effort moved to the United States. The British have always maintained, with varying degrees of bluntness, that their understanding was that the technology and the whole project would be a joint project. It would be fully shared. As you probably know, the United States reneged on that commitment, if there was a commitment, after the Second World War, and the British proceeded to develop their initial nuclear weapons almost entirely on their own. Then there were changes in the law, and we opened up cooperation. It's important to remember that there are two aspects of the cooperation. One is the nuclear, on nuclear weapons technology. The British are the only country with whom we cooperate on nuclear weapons technology per se. And the second is the missiles, the delivery systems. The British nuclear weapons at all times have been British nuclear weapons. They're built in Britain. They're built to a British design, which is not identical to our designs. And there's a lot of interchange. Footnote. Sometimes people argue that one of the advantages, and I think this wouldn't be a reason to do the program in and of itself, but one of the advantages to the cooperation is that American nuclear scientists, not weapons technologists, but nuclear scientists, have somebody to talk to. There's somebody else who's in the business. Scientists, technologists tend to work to a remarkable degree by kind of exchanging ideas and trying out different approaches and so on. So the argument is made, and I think there's something to it, that it is to our advantage to have an ongoing parallel British weapons development program, for not just for development, but for safety and security and all that kind of thing. Anyway, I think I don't think even the British would dispute that even on the nuclear side, the United States effort is massively larger than theirs, and that the net flow of technology has certainly been to the British rather than the other way, but there's some that comes back and forth. And, on the missile side and the submarine side, the British design and build their own submarines or their own nuclear reactors. There's some cooperation between the navies on that score. The missiles are an American design, which is basically the British buy a full-up missile with some modest modifications to make their warheads compatible with it, but to a very considerable degree, they have to design the warheads to be compatible with the missile rather than the other way around.
You've obviously worked in several different presidential administrations. Have you felt that there has been a difference in the way certain presidents treated the Mutual Defense Agreement, or has it been consistent across the board?
Well, I think it's clear that in 1977, the British were genuinely concerned at whether President Carter would be willing to continue the cooperative relationship. I think they were very quickly reassured on that point. And I think President Carter made a decision quite early on that, well, there were details to be worked out and so on, that he had no intention of stopping the cooperation program. The cooperation with Britain, I don't think, has ever been terribly controversial. I mean, there was a terrible fiasco in the Kennedy administration, not about the nuclear program, but about the support of what at that time was an effort to jointly develop, I guess, an air-launched rocket called Skybolt. And rather early in the Kennedy administration, the Defense Department decided the United States didn't want it. The British couldn't afford to develop it. No problem. The British couldn't afford to develop it on their own. And obviously the British got a terrific deal, because instead of getting a very bad idea, which was this supersonic bomber, they bought in at a pretty reasonable price. They bought into a system, the Polaris system, which is ideal for what they need, which is a small force, but very secure, something they could never do with the air-breathing system. But I don't, you know, I can't speak for the administrations I didn't work for, and when I worked for the Bush administration, had nothing to do with the British nuclear deterrent. I think it's fair to say that all American administrations have regarded the alliance with the British as very important, and have regarded the nuclear cooperation as a part of that. The issues during the Carter administration had much more to do, first of all, with kind of doing what lawyers would call due diligence. That is, yeah, it sounds like a good idea, but is it really? Let's take, what is sort of what this is about, this memo from Brzezinski. Let's really be sure, let's think about it and not do it just because the British are nice guys and we fought in the war together and so on. But I think it was important to reassure on that front. And the obvious issue always was nonproliferation. That is it inconsistent with our nonproliferation policy that we provide technology and assistance to the British in their program? That's an issue. I don't think it's a serious issue, but it's an issue.
Was this a legal issue?
No. No, there's no question that the cooperation is legal. I mean, there are hoops you have to go through and restrictions and so on, but those go back to the modifications of the Atomic Energy Act, I think, in the Eisenhower administration. And I suppose different administrations have gotten on to different degrees with the British. Then there was also the issue of money. The British pay for this, and there's naturally an argument about what they pay for, how much they pay, and do they pay their fair share, and do we... Our position is, do the British pay their fair share? The British position is, you're going to do this anyway. Obviously, we'll pay for the British never dispute they'd pay for the incremental cost. The question was, what if any share of the developmental cost were they supposed to put in? That was always an argument. And then there was a very serious issue, I think, in some people's minds, maybe more important in the Defense Department than other places, that we, the United States, and certainly the Carter administration, were always pressing the Europeans to do more on conventional defense. And we were always anxious to try to make sure that British spending on their nuclear deterrent did not in effect come out of their conventional program. And as you know, there are Brits who maintained at the time that there was a view, mostly unsurprisingly associated with the British Army, that it would be better for Britain to spend the money on conventional forces, which would make a greater contribution to British security and rely on the Americans, essentially, for nuclear deterrence. So the argument was, well, the British spent, I don't know, probably 10-15% of their defense budget on the independent turret. And there was a view in some circles, more I think in Britain actually than the United States, that you could take that money and spend it more productively on conventional forces. And at least the American position was to make sure that we got some kind of commitments out of the British on maintaining the level of their conventional defense effort if they were going to go forward with Trident. As you probably know, one of the quirks in this was that by about the time the British had kind of gotten everything wrapped up for the C-4, the initial Trident missile, the United States basically decided that it was going to go for an improvement on that missile, Trident 2, the D-5, which is what we now deploy. And the British had to scurry around and get the Reagan administration to agree essentially to do the same deal for the D-5 as we had agreed to do for C-4, and there were various technical complications of that. But again, going back to your basic question, I don't think there was any real doubt on the part of either the Carter or the Reagan administration that we would go forward. I honestly don't know where it stands now. I mean, I think there's no question that the United States will continue to cooperate with the British, who have to replace their submarines someday. That's what the British issue is. So the British have committed to doing it. I've honestly forgotten what the state of play is on our continued cooperation on the missile program and on the submarines.
What do you think the strategic importance is of Britain maintaining their independent nuclear deterrent now that the Soviet Union has collapsed and the initial reason?
Well, I think the same answer. I think that question can only be answered in the context of why does it make sense for anybody to maintain a nuclear deterrent. But I think the real answer is it's a hedge against uncertainty in the future.
Which is the white paper official statement as well.
I think there are a couple of issues. One is, and it's certainly the case for the British, that they regard their possession of nuclear weapons as an important element in being serious about national defense. Obviously, nuclear weapons for everybody, at least for the NATO countries, are much less salient than they were during the Cold War. And I think there are serious questions about that I think the United States has to grapple with in the coming years about exactly what is our strategic rationale for having very large, very sophisticated nuclear forces. For various reasons, and I confess I don't fully understand, we have the luxury of being able to put off replacement decisions longer than the Brits because of the way the nuclear reactors are designed for the submarine. But I think both countries are going to have to, and the French for that matter, who have also committed to going forward. Three countries are going to have to do it in the context of a view about what nuclear weapons are for. I think to some degree developments in Russia make it less implausible than it would have been, say, 10 years ago to say, well, you know, there's no question that the Russians under Putin are not, it's not the Soviet Union under Brezhnev, but it kind of reminds us that Russia has still, by orders of magnitude, the second largest nuclear capability in the world, and things could go wrong and our relationships could change, and we want to maintain a nuclear capability. And then all these arguments about second centers of decision and British independence and so on continue to apply.
For all the reasons you just mentioned, would now perhaps be a good time to redefine the agreement?
I don't honestly see why. There's a sort of, the British have of course, as we have drastically reduced the number of weapons. The British have a problem that they have to keep, I think they have, is it four or five, honestly, I forget, it's embarrassing. I used to be able to tell their names. I think the British have four submarines.
Yeah.
That's what I, the French I think have five. The British have to maintain a submarine fleet of a certain size in order to be able to have a submarine on station all the time. But they've drastically cut back on the number of weapons that they carry. And that, I think, is a good thing, and I think the United States could afford to cut back substantially more than we have, and I wouldn't be surprised, I hope, when a new administration, whether it's Democrat or Republican, will take some hard looks at that. And that issue is a real one. I think the British are close to the level, to the minimum size, well, they are at the level of a minimum size of a submarine force to have a meaningful deterrent, and they're close to the level of a minimum size of a weapons inventory. And I continue to think that the cooperation program on both the nuclear front and the submarines and the missiles is in our interest and should continue along the same basic pattern.
Shifting back to your time on the National Security Council staff, when you worked on arms control issues, what were the, and this is 69 to 70, as you said before, what were the main arms control issues being dealt with when it came to nuclear policy?
You mean in general or related to the British?
In general, but if you could talk about it in general.
The general issue is what kind of a, well, I suppose the initial core issue was what kind of a strategic doctrine did the United States have? What kind of force were we going to maintain? This was the era of moving to MIRVs, whether we were going to have a ballistic missile defense. But more immediately, what were we going to try to agree with the Soviets on as part of the SALT agreement?
And in relation to our relationship with the British?
The issue with the British on the SALT treaty was what came to be called the non-circumvention clause. The Soviets maintained, not entirely irrationally from their point of view, that they faced three NATO nuclear countries, and that if the American force was A and the British force was B and the French force was F, the Soviet limit should be A plus B plus F. That is, that it was all one conglomerate that the Americans ran, and why should they have to pretend that the British and French were separate when they were being really nasty to it, especially the British, which is run as a sort of wholly, in their view, run as a sort of wholly owned subsidiary of the American force. And the United States took the position that Britain and France are independent countries, and that whatever the theoretical merits, that treaty had to say that the United States would not the treaty did not limit, I think the phrase was, customary practices of cooperation on the part of the United States, a position we'd taken in the NPT as well. This was all complicated by the fact that the Nixon administration, well, this actually was after I worked on the NSC, but it was a big issue in the SALT negotiations in the Carter administration. The Nixon administration had agreed to a provision in the ABM treaty, which essentially said we wouldn't transfer ABM technology to anybody else. And the Russians said, well, you agreed to it about defensive weapons, you should agree to it about offensive weapons. And we said, sort of like what Huckabee said about flagpoles in South Carolina.
Yeah, you mentioned NATO a few minutes ago. In the post-Cold War world, where do you see nuclear weapons fitting into our NATO alliance?
That's a good question. I mean, I think, again, it raises the broader issue of what's NATO about. I think in the immediate sense, NATO is much more symbolized by what's going on in Afghanistan and Kosovo and so on. And from time to time in Africa, you know, that NATO has become an organization which is a common front between the United States and Western Europe and Canada to deal with security issues very broadly defined. And as to most of that, nuclear weapons have no role at all, no, let's be honest. But, and with the problems with the Russians, people, especially the Poles and to some degree other Central Europeans, say it is also about the defense of the home territories of the NATO allies. Obvious potential threat. Nobody says it's a current threat, but times change. Things which seem fine get bad. The NATO position, as I assume you know, is that NATO reserves the right to use nuclear weapons if necessary. Hope it'll never be necessary, shouldn't be necessary. We should do things to make sure it's not necessary and all that. But if push comes to shove, we're going to maintain a capacity for deterrence, for nuclear deterrence, as well as for diplomacy and conventional deterrence. I assume that policy will stay. I mean, for my money, we ought to get rid of the dual-capable aircraft. But they wouldn't make a whole lot of difference one way or the other, whether we did or not.
Specifically, why is that people who should get rid of dual-capable aircraft?
They've never made much sense.
So, sort of an overkill issue?
No, not so much overkill, because there's not enough of them to make an overkill argument. Well, let's start out. First of all, I have an objection in principle. We pretend they don't exist. And the only people we fool by pretending they don't exist is, I don't know, I can't believe we even fool any members of the Western European publics. Because it's very interesting. Google NATO nuclear aircraft and get pictures of the bunkers where the nuclear weapons are. It's not, it's got to be the world's worst kept secret. It seems to me, at a very minimum, we should, if we're going to maintain them, we should maintain them openly. And, you know, they're in, according to Google, they're in various European countries, none of which officially acknowledge they're there, which I find absurd on a variety of grounds. Second, they're absurdly vulnerable. I mean, if you're going to talk about a nuclear and a situation in which you might think about using them, we spend a great deal of money to have, and the British and French do too, to have a submarine force which is invisible, invulnerable, nobody knows where it is. We spend a lot of money to have ICBM silos, which, to a good first approximation, you've got to get a direct hit with a nuclear weapon to do them any damage. The bombers are secured by the interrelationship between the missiles and the bomber bases. So what you've got here is a bunch of bunkers, which everybody with a Michelin guide can tell where they are. There are some real security issues. There have been, let's put it this way, there have been some real security issues from time to time. They're modestly expensive. If the F-16s which carry them are not going to last forever, if the Europeans are going to replace the F-16s, they'd have to equip them to carry nuclear weapons, whatever they were going to put them on. They'd have to equip them to carry nuclear weapons, which is complicated. Most of the pilots are not actually nuclear qualified. They're, I think they're an anachronism. they were sort of an anachronism from the day they were put in, which was the idea that it would be a shared. Countries that would nominally not have nuclear weapons, their air forces would have airplanes that would carry American nuclear weapons. I mean, I suppose if the countries in question really think it's important, I wouldn't break a whole lot of crockery about getting rid of them. But I don't know that the countries in question really think it's important, and I find it paradoxical that if they think it's so important, why are they afraid to tell their publics that they're doing it?
Interesting. You mentioned earlier,
the NATO nuclear deterrent doesn't depend on this handful of aging F-16s with gravity bombs. It depends on the British and the American submarine, and in the case of the American long range, and the French, and the long range missile force, and for that matter, the American long range bombers, which do not carry gravity bombs, and are not F-16s, and are not deployed within. Artillery range of the enemy.
The enemy who is undefined.
Well, it's the Russians. Let's be honest.
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier that.
But the Russians are huffing and puffing about what awful things they're going to do and how they're going to use nuclear weapons if they want to, and so anyway.
You mentioned earlier you could perceive the next presidential administration doing a drawdown of our nuclear arsenal. Do you see a new bilateral arms agreement with, say, Russia in the near future?
Well, one problem is the START agreement expires at the end of 2009. Even this administration, as I understand it, has begun some discussions with the Russians about what to do about that. Partly because the Moscow Treaty, which provides for... I mean, you can... joke and say it provides it at one moment on midnight on whatever it is, the end of 2012, I guess, the numbers have to be a certain level and there are no rules about anything else. But nobody really believes that's what the treaty means. And it is in effect supported by the verification arrangements and all the counting rules that this administration has such disdain for in the START agreement. Certainly if it's a Democratic administration, I would be very surprised if there isn't a serious effort to, in some form or another, extend the START agreement and expand it, probably with lower levels and probably integrate it into the Moscow Treaty structure. I would actually be surprised if even a Republican administration was entirely happy with the idea of completely abandoning, particularly the verification provisions. Although there is an ideological position in the Republican Party that we still have to bury the ghost of Richard Nixon and Jimmy Carter. It's their privilege.
So opposed to coming up with an entirely new agreement, you perceived rather an extension of current agreements.
Well, I mean, I can... First of all, I wouldn't be surprised to see an extension of the agreement just so you get rid of the negotiating deadline of 2009, which for a new administration to negotiate, ratify, and put in place a new treaty in a year is a pretty tall order. It might not be impossible, but it's a pretty tall order. I mean, my own view is that we should... You can reduce the numbers, and you probably should reduce the numbers, and it's a good idea. I've never believed that the absolute numbers are the problem. If we were really going to address the issue, we would focus on trying to bring shorter-range systems, of which these F-16s are an example, but the Russians have lots, probably maybe order of magnitude more than we do, which is one of the reasons it's hard to negotiate about it. Try to bring that within the system. Try to deal with some of the proliferation-related safety and security types of issues. In addition to reducing the numbers and ensuring transparency, I mean, we, as our relationship with the Russians deteriorates, we ought to be more rather than less interested in having an agreement. You know, we had an agreement with the Soviet Union on these issues. And this absurd position of the right wing of the Republican Party that the Russians are our friends and therefore we don't need to worry about verification except when they're our enemies, in which case we don't really need to worry about arms control, is kind of silly.
I assume that maintaining the nuclear arsenal must be vastly expensive.
Not particularly.
A few billion.
Well, it's a few billion,
yeah.
Yes.
So,
but,
well,
but as a percentage of the defense budget, it's down to practically, well, not practically nothing, because, you know, as Dirksen said, a billion here, a billion there, it adds up. It is funny, we've now gotten to the stage where some kid trading hedge futures can run through $1 billion all since the beginning of the year. Did you know that? That it's he made a little money last year. And but I mean, made a little money for the bank last year and ran through what, $7 billion in 3 weeks. Anyway, no, the nuclear program is almost lost in the rounding. I don't know what it's
2 or 3% now that Great Britain has tentatively decided to modernize their nuclear deterrent, and the United States funding for the ROW program is stalled. Congress didn't approve it.
Well, they're very different issues. Well, I don't think they have any connection with each other. That's the first thing I think. As I said, for technical reasons, at least allegedly, which is true, the British submarines are going to wear out before the American submarines. The missiles are just fine. The new British submarines will presumably carry the D-5 missile. One of the problems that the British agonize over is if they get their program out of phase with the American, they run into the problem they were worried about in the early 80s, which is they had just committed to Trident 1. They suddenly woke up and realized, hey, wait a minute, by the time we get any of these submarines, the Americans will be basically out of the Trident 1 business, and we'll have what we do not want, which is a British unique missile. I mean, a lot of what goes on in this program is dealing with that kind of technical, practical, kind of engineer type of problem, but that's not a policy. I believe that the reason that RRW didn't work, the whole deep penetrator issue, conventional Trident, to some degree even the so-called third ABM site, all those issues I think are going to have to be dealt with next year by a new administration. And I think it certainly makes sense that they should be dealt with in the context of an overall approach to strategic nuclear weapons, or indeed nuclear weapons policy. I think the reason RRW didn't go anywhere is, A, Congress is deeply suspicious of the administration on almost everything. B, is very concerned that this is the opposite of what it purports to be, that it is, in fact, a stalking horse to resume nuclear testing. I mean, one of the arguments about this, I don't honestly know what I think about it, but one of the arguments is, as long as we keep the exact same warhead designs we have now, you're confident, at least as confident as you can be, that they work. Soon as you begin to tinker with the design, you get worried about unknowns in terms of whether they work, and usually not so much whether they work as how well they work, what the yield is. And therefore, people who are of a suspicious turn of mind will say, you just watch, we'll develop this thing, and then the labs will announce that, well, gee, unless we test it, we won't know for sure, so we got to test it. If you're suspicious of the nuclear mafia, you're suspicious of the nuclear mafia.
And what would you say to somebody who would argue that you are, you have an equal level of deterrence with 1,000 ICBMs than 6,000 ICBMs. And why do we need so many when...
Well, we don't have 6,000. We never have had 6,000.
I was just sorry. I don't know.
No, well, I understand. Well, I know. I agree the number could go down. I don't dispute that at all. One of the questions, at the risk of sounding like President Clinton, is what do you mean by the number? From the British point of view, and it's a good illustration, the sort of bedrock British deterrent is however many weapons there are on the submarine that's at sea. Because if you are concerned, as to some degree you have to be, about a bolt from the blue surprise attack, any submarines that are in port are gone. They don't count. It's only the submarines that are at sea, and we have the same issue to some degree. That number is a rather small fraction of the sort of published number. Even the published number for deployed warheads means all of the warheads that are on all the submarines, at least all the submarines that are not in overhaul. We don't count the ones in overhaul anymore. All of the ICBMs and all of the bombers in the force. None of the bombers are on alert. All the missiles are on alert. I guess another issue a lot of people would put on the list of topics to think about for the future is the so-called de-alerting issue. I've never been able to get excited about that, but there are people who are excited. My problem is that the safest, most secure nuclear weapons in the world are the British, French, American, and Russian, and probably Chinese strategic, in everybody's equivalent of the Russian strategic rocket forces. Everybody knows where they are. They're under elaborate controls. Nobody has to move them. But there may be things you could do that would reduce the, I think, almost entirely fictional dangers, as this awful incident with the, I think it was Barksdale, which is where they're going, other people call it Minot, which is where they came from, the ACM screw-up. That's the kind of problem I think we ought to worry much more about than the supposed problems of, quote, hair trigger alert. But people will certainly want to put that on the agenda, and there may be useful things you can do.
About a year ago, George Shultz, William Perry, Henry Kissinger, and Sam Nunn wrote this op-ed, A World Free...
I know.
And, ultimately working towards the Reagan ideal of a nuclear-free world.
Well, it's not just Reagan's idea.
Yeah, I'm just to quote one person.
No, I understand.
Is this a real possibility? Or is any serious presidential administration ever going to consider adopting this policy?
That policy or the policy of having no nuclear weapons? Because that policy is not a policy of having no nuclear weapons. That policy makes a lot of sense. My problem with actually going to a situation in which the United States didn't have nuclear weapons is that if you could figure out some way to make, my way of putting it is, make uranium not fission, that might be a good idea. Probably would be a good idea, but can't. And the current situation in which the United States and the other countries have nuclear weapons has its problems. But since you would never... arms control has always gone aground on verification. And one of the reasons that the arms control agreements with the Soviet Union were acceptable was that they were not actually... there was very little payoff from cheating. I mean, as you say, if the limit is, what is it in this Moscow Treaty, 2,200-something, 1,800 to 2,200, something like that. Those numbers are so large. Well, I mean, what difference? In one sense, I mean, as a matter of principle, it would be terrible. I mean, the collapse of the agreement, it would be a political challenge of the highest order. But what actual strategic difference would it make if it turned out, gee, the Russians, and let's assume the number's 1,800. It's really embarrassing. I can't remember these anymore. If instead of 1,800, the Russians have 2,400, which is in excess of the limit. I mean, it would be a huge issue. but strategically it wouldn't make much difference. On the other hand, if the limit is zero, having one is a big deal. I think that's, in a nutshell, that's the problem with imagining you're really going to go to a nuclear-free world. You can certainly, and I think also to some degree, it's the best is the enemy of the good. I mean, it's kind of like saying, are you in favor of a world without hunger? Yes, it would be a good thing if there was no hunger in the world. Now, we've now settled that. Now let's talk about how we're actually going to improve, get the calorie level in Central Africa up from 900 to 1200. What is Emerson said, a man's reach should exceed his grasp, or what's a heaven for? And I think the idea that you ought to adopt as a principle reducing reliance on nuclear weapons, which we've certainly done, reducing numbers, which we've done to a very large extent, increasing their security, which is we can do more about, as even we have learned. Also, I think very importantly addressing this issue that there's a whole lot of nuclear weapons out there that we barely know our own. I mean, obviously the system knows its numbers. The American public barely knows the number of American non-strategic nuclear weapons, and it's a small number, it's a few hundred. At least, as of the last time I had access to this information, we have only the vaguest idea how many Russian non-strategic nuclear weapons there are, where they are, how they're secured, or what the doctrine is for them. So, now, we made a lot of progress in the early 90s by getting rid of whole classes of nuclear weapons. We had all kinds of crazy stuff. We had nuclear landmines and nuclear anti-aircraft missiles and nuclear torpedoes and nuclear depth charges. All those have disappeared, which is a very good thing. But I guess it maybe in a funny way it's the argument between Martin Luther King and Lyndon Johnson. In some sense, you need both. You need the ideal of saying nuclear weapons are a real problem, you ought to reduce reliance on them, get them under better control, and that in some ways the way to focus that effort is to say a world without nuclear weapons would be a good thing, and how close can we get to that? I have a lot of difficulty with it as a practical objective.
Yeah. I have a question about...
I mean, it's like, wouldn't it be nice to have a world without weapons, without armies? Yeah, it would be. Sure, but mostly because it would be nice to have a world in which you didn't need armies, not so much because it would be nice to have a world in which you didn't have armies if it was the same as the world is now.
We want to talk kind of about your personal experiences and special relationship. Are there any British counterparts you specifically recall working with? And can you tell us what this was like on a personal level for you?
Oh, actually, it's one of the reasons I was taking sort of seriously this argument about it's good to have people to talk to about this. The British, and indeed for that matter the French, have a small cadre of people who thought a lot about this. Michael Quinlan was and is a good friend. He and I signed the implementing document on the hood of a car at the British Embassy over lunch. There were a number of other Brits whom I got to know pretty well. None as close personally as Michael.
Were there ever any tensions?
Sure. I mean, part of this was an argument about money. Arguments about money are always, especially between friends, are always unpleasant.
How much do you think the special partnership is driven by diplomatic considerations and how much by personal relationships?
Almost entirely by, I wouldn't say diplomatic, but by national interest. I mean, I think personal relationships are certainly important. I remember once, right after one of Vance's trips to Moscow for the SALT negotiations, Warnke, who you probably have never heard of, but was the head of the Arms Control Agency, and I was one of the men for whom I have a great of admiration. He and I and some other people, I mean, he was the head of the team. Vance went on to do something else, but he went around Europe to brief the Allies on what we had done. We were in Bonn, I think, and that was important because the Germans were very suspicious. I remember Paul beginning the meeting, and this was with the Germans, not the British, by saying, after a week of rather heavy-handed Soviet hospitality, it's nice to be back among real friends. the British don't give anything away, but, and they're masters at manipulating Americans. I have a British friend who said that the secret of British diplomacy is that in a time of crisis, I offer the United States all assistance short of actual help. Now, that's not fair. But talking about the personal aspect of it, I've always believed that the British have figured out that Americans love to be liked. And if you're sort of friendly, the Americans won't notice that you're being stabbed in the back. Whereas the French delight on being difficult. And one of the things about this same era, you probably remember the boycott of the Moscow Olympics. Well, the French boycotted, the British didn't. The French took the position that the invasion of Afghanistan is an affront, it's a threat to world stability. It will tell the French athletes to stay home. The British said, amateur sport, you know, and it's all done. That's a trivial example. But I think the French are so difficult because they take these things seriously. And they have a logical approach that often comes out very pragmatically, but they have to get to it through a... Whereas we used to joke, this non-circumvention issue was it was the main link between arms control issues and the British and French programs, and also the relationship with the Germans, who it's hard to remember now, but during the Cold War, our relationships with Europe were about 90% our relationships with West Germany, because they were on the frontier of the Cold War. And the British position was, as long as you tell us that whatever the treaty says, you will go on doing what you're doing, that's fine. Write the treaty any way it works. French said, we don't believe you anyway, and that's why we have an independent territory. You do whatever you want. We trust you. We believe you. Go ahead. But we will have an independent deterrent, so we don't depend on American transfers or cooperation.
To what extent?
And the Germans said it has to be theoretically correct. Language. We have no interest in any nuclear cooperation with you. It would drive German politics crazy. But we cannot agree to anything being in the treaty which would prohibit the cooperation. So we had a meeting once with a German lawyer. I remember it vividly because it was a huge snowstorm. And it took, I think, an hour to get back from the White House to the Pentagon after this meeting. This is the reason I can remember the circumstances. And the German lawyer, we had this long, two or three paragraph statement on what the non-circumvention clause didn't mean, which basically said it didn't prohibit anything it seemed to prohibit. And the German came in with some immensely theoretical argument about that this was a treaty and it limited sovereignty, and under international law, agreements limiting sovereignty to be broadly construed. And he was going on about this, and the eyes of all the non-lawyers in the room glazed over. And I said, well, that's kind of an interesting idea. And he said, he looked at me and he said, you all think I'm being difficult. I'm actually trying to solve this problem. So I said, ah, that's the difference between a civil legal system and a common law system, an American system, of course, being a common law system. And it is a well-known principle of American and British common law that statutes in derogation of the common law are to be strictly construed. So we'll just write that in at the beginning, that the non-circumvention clause is to be strictly construed. And he said, that solves the problem. But the whole issue, I think the whole issue during the Cold War of nuclear cooperation and of, I mean, the British position was it was a practical cooperation they cared about. Interesting couple of phrases in this, but the French are the French. The German position was Germany has, as a matter of national choice, agreed not to have nuclear weapons. But they did not want that to be a matter of the United States and the Soviet Union imposing that rule on the Germans. I mean, there are other treaties which impose it on the Germans, including, of course, the NPT.
To what extent do you feel like the British nuclear deterrent is independent?
It's independent in any practical sense. I mean, there's a big argument in Britain, and the United States doesn't care. There's a big argument in Britain it's not really independent because the submarines require U.S. spare parts and so on. In that sense, it's not. But for all, you know, the British, first of all, the British could probably keep it going if they had to by themselves. It's all a question of money. Second, if Britain and the United States relationships got to the point where we weren't supporting we weren't doing what we are obligated to do, the least of the British problems would be the deterioration, and the least of their security problems would be the deterioration over in the submarines. The weapons are their own design. But it's certainly true that the British are dependent on an American umbilical. But you know, in some sense, the harsh fact is British security depends very heavily in an existential threat. British security depends very heavily on the American alliance anyway.
How do you think that the U.S. and U.K. differ in diplomatic approaches to non-proliferation currently? We have partnerships
sure.
Like the PSI and Global Initiative to Combat Nuclear Terrorism, but I think domestically the U.S. and the U.K. approach...
I honestly don't know enough about the British approach.
Well, I mean, like Gordon Brown said... yesterday in a speech that when the NPT comes up for ratification in 2010 that they're going to be advocating...
It doesn't come up for renewal. It may. There's a review conference.
That was one of the most
enjoyable operations we did in the Clinton administration for sheer kind of bureaucratic effectiveness. The treaty originally was written that had to be renewed every 5 years, 10 years, 25 years, I forgot, but it came up for renewal. And we decided that we wanted to make it perpetual, indefinite treaty, so we didn't have to go through this every whatever many years. And everybody had operated on the principle that it would have to be by consensus. Then somebody in the Pentagon read the treaty. And it said it could be renewed, it could be extended indefinitely. That what was done about the renewal was by a majority vote of the parties, and therefore you could extend it indefinitely by a majority vote. So all we need is a majority. So we got a list of all the countries, and we did what you would do in a sorority election. You know, the British are okay, the French are okay, the Germans are okay. We got people to sign up. This was in the middle of when we'd occupied Haiti. And the Haitians were actually a member of the treaty. And I remember a meeting with the Deputy Secretary of Defense, and we talked about Haitian issues. At the very end, he said, you know, Haiti's a member of the NPT. We need your vote. And the foreign minister of Haiti said, I didn't know we were a member of the NPT. Of course you have our vote. We got jerkwater little countries in the Pacific to sign up because their vote was as good as the Egyptians. And then, of course, And we had, you know, we literally had a war room that had tabulations of who was, like, what'll happen if the convention's deadlocked. You get very interested in every delegate. Tonga's vote was important. And so the ambassador, and we sent around to the world that every ambassador in every little country in the UN should go in, because they're all in the NPT, get their vote, indicate that the United States would not like it if they voted wrong on this. And of course, once we had a majority, we were in the driver's seat, because we could do whatever we couldn't, as a practical matter, but as a matter of legal form, we could force through a change in the treaty. Countries could withdraw from the treaty if they wanted to. At that point, we got consensus. What did Gordon Brown say about that? Gordon Brown will be lucky to be there in 2010.
When it comes up for review, the British nuclear posture will be changed, and they'll be advocating disarmament. A world free of nuclear weapons, I think, is even what he said in his speech.
So he's also committed. Well, but he's also committed to. I'll have to read the speech, but he's also committed to maintain the British nuclear deterrent, because he said that before he became prime minister.
So you think it's just primarily for public opinion purposes?
I have no idea. Since I don't know exactly what he said, I wouldn't be surprised if it's some variant on that excellent piece. I mean, there's a lot in that I agree with. I think there is a real danger that the best is the enemy of the ideal in this. I mean, the ideal is the enemy of the best. The ideal is the enemy of the practical. And I don't mean just, you know, whatever you can get. I mean very important, very far-reaching things, but that do not actually abolish nuclear weapons, and can always be criticized on the grounds that they do not actually abolish nuclear weapons. And I'd have to read what Brown said.
Thank you very much, sir.
Are there more unclassified? More declassified documents on this? There must be some.
Can we just ask you one final question? Do you have any advice for future policymakers, either on the U.S. or the U.K. side, ways that we could further cooperate?
Or, with the British?
Yeah. What are your opinions about current cooperation and advice for continuing the partnership?
Well, I think it's in our interest. I've never believed, I think we get a huge benefit out of the relationship with the British. And I think to some degree we've always haggled a little bit too much about the money. Because the British argument that you're going to spend this anyway, why should we have to run around and contribute? But, I mean, our argument is you get part of the benefit. It's like, I assume neither of you have families, but it's not yet. It's like saying, what does it cost to take an extra? Well, if you're going on a trip, what does it cost to take an extra person? And you're going to drive a car. Well, the extra weight in the car doesn't actually add very much to the expense. But if you said, four or five of us are going to pile in a car and go skiing, and we'll share the expenses. Well, suppose you said, I'm going to go skiing, I'll get three or four of my friends, and we'll all go, and we will, quote, share expenses. The other people then say, wait a minute, you were going to go anyway. We'll buy our own food. We're not arguing about that. We'll buy our own lift tickets. But you were going to drive. You were going to rent the condo for you and your significant other, and the rest of us will crowd in. And, you know, it's one of the hardest problems in accounting is to figure out what is the. And the person driving the car would say, wait a minute, I mean, there are five of us, we'll divide the cost of the car five ways, and we'll divide the cost of the condo five ways. You guys drink more than I do anyway, so you have to pay. But I'll pay your fifth of the drink, but I eat more than you do, and you pay my, you know. Or other people say, no, we've got to keep track of, you know, how many people drank, how many, like going out That's essentially the problem. The British, the American position was the British were getting the benefit of the R&D and they should pay some part of it. We always maintain the British got a bargain. They always maintain they got screwed, which is the way most arguments like this turn out.
Thank you so much for your time, sir. It's
incredibly sure. Helpful. You know, with all respect, there are a lot of public documents on this. And I assume you can get a lot off the web. And a lot of the Nixon-era stuff is being declassified.